This is Focus 580, our morning talk program, hour number two of the show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Producing the program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Henry Frayne is at the controls this morning. Beginning in 1915, something like a million Armenians were killed through starvation, forced marches, forced exile, and mass acts of slaughter. World opinion, and certainly the Armenian people, have held the leaders of the Ottoman Empire responsible. However, for the past 90 years, Turkey has rejected any claim of international genocide, and indeed, even talking about this can be a punishable offense today in Turkey. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking with one of the very few Turkish historians to acknowledge this genocide and to uncover significant evidence to undergird the claim that, in fact, that it did occur and that it was a result of a deliberate policy by the government of Turkey. Our guest is Taner Akçam. He is the author of a book entitled A Shameful Act. The subtitle is The Armenian Genocide and the Question of Turkish Responsibility. It was published by Metropolitan Books just last November. Should be out in the bookstores if you want to take a look at the book. And also, I do want to mention that our guest, Taner Akçam, will be here on the campus of the University of Illinois a little bit later this week. He'll be here on Thursday, the 8th, and he will give a talk on the subject at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. It's sponsored by the Russian, East European, and Eurasian Center, also co-sponsored by the folks in the program in South Asian and Middle Eastern Studies. And this will be in room 126 of the Library and Information Science Building on East Daniel in Champaign. And I'm sure anyone who is interested in attending the talk should feel welcome. Otherwise, as I said, if you would like to read on the subject, you can go to the bookstore at the library and look for our guest's book, A Shameful Act. A little bit more about him. He was born in Turkey in 1953, became interested in politics early on. As editor-in-chief of a student political journal, he was arrested in 1976 and sentenced to 10 years imprisonment. Amnesty International adopted him as one of their first prisoners of conscience, and a year later he escaped to Germany, where he received political asylum. He went to school there. He began in 1988 research at the Hamburg Institute for Social Research, did research on the late Ottoman Empire and early Republic, especially the history of political violence and torture in Turkey. And at that time, he started to become interested in the Armenian genocide. He got his doctorate in 96, writing on that very subject. Since 2002, he's been a visiting associate professor of history at the University of Minnesota. And he's joining us this morning by telephone. As we talk, questions are welcome. 333-9455. That's for folks who are here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers, and at any point here, people who have questions are certainly welcome to call. Professor Akçam, hello.
Hi.
Thank you for talking with us today.
It's nice for me to have in your program.
In the book, you note that the official Turkish position on the genocide, of course they wouldn't use that word, but the official Turkish position is in fact, yes, indeed, hundreds of thousands of Armenians did die. But they say that this was not deliberate policy. This was, as you write here in the book, a tragic but unintended byproduct of the war, of World War I.
Yes.
And then you go on to write that this argument rests on the claim that the Ottoman sources contain no evidence showing a deliberate policy of systematic killing. Your basic argument is, and you certainly present it as the result of your research, is indeed that there is evidence that shows there was a deliberate policy of systematic killing, yes?
Yes, especially the Prime Ministerial Archive in Istanbul holds a significant number of documents that clearly shows the genocidal intent of the Ottoman authorities, and some of these documents I published in my book.
Let's talk a little bit, or I would ask you to talk a little bit about what life was like for the Armenian population of the Ottoman Empire before 1915. What were conditions like? How did these people live?
There were, according to Ottoman statistics, 1.3 million. According to Armenian church statistics, 2.1 million Armenians, living in Ottoman Empire, and most of them were peasants and living today's Eastern Turkey, what Armenian called historic land. And as I said, 70-75% of them were peasants, poor people mostly, but then the other part were living in Istanbul and in other great big cities, and mostly busy in the business, mostly.
Mm-hmm. And were they considered to be full citizens?
At that time, until 1912, actually, it was not a major problem for the Ottoman authorities. They were mostly, the Ottoman authorities dealt with the problem in Balkan. And Armenian organizations during that period, especially between 1908, this was the beginning of constitutional monarchy in Ottoman Empire, Armenian organization were in the same alliance with the Union and Progress Party. They were cooperating, working together. They were two strong nationalist organizations, Dashnaks from Armenian sides, Union and Progress from Turkish side. They were, for example, participating in the elections in the same side. So until Balkan War, there were a cooperation and working together between two organizations. It changed after the Balkan War.
Mm-hmm. And I think probably for people to understand here, the important context is that within the Ottoman Empire, there was a genuine fear that it would be dismembered. And so as a result, they would have seen it as a way of protecting the heartland, the Anatolia, what now is Turkey. It seemed that they embarked on a policy of what we would now call ethnic cleansing, making the decision to expel the Armenians who were Christians, and also for that matter Muslims who were not Turkish.
It is true. I would like to make it very clear to the listeners, only 1912, in October, within 1 week, the Ottoman authorities lost their 69% of territories in European part and 75% of their population. This was a continuous dismemberment of the empire, and this was their major fear. And they all wanted to keep this empire together. And after the loss of major territories in European part, they thought now it is time for the Anatolia. The Armenian are going to establish their independent state. And there were indeed some reform agreements between big powers and the Ottoman Empire, which resulted in an autonomous region, to establish an autonomous region in eastern Anatolia, and the Ottoman rulers thought that it was the beginning of an independent Armenian state, and they tried to hinder this process. And this was the reason also why they entered in the First World War. And when they entered in the war, the first thing that they did, the Ottoman authorities, to annul these reform agreements so that there could be no autonomy in eastern provinces for the Armenians. So this is a very important point, this feeling of demise of the empire.
And I'm sure that you would, and people should understand that it's not advanced as any kind of excuse for what the government did, simply as a way of saying, here, understand the feeling of the way in which the government felt threatened and saw the dissolution of the empire as something that was almost certain, or at least that they were going to try to do whatever they could to
exactly.
avoid that.
Exactly. It is in all genocides the case. The Nazis were also felt threatened by the existence of Jews, for example. So this concept of threat is very strong, and among the Ottoman rulers also, they felt threatened with the existence of the Armenians, and this was their major problem, and we can never justify a genocidal act because of these sort of feelings.
The places where the Armenians were living would have been adjacent to that part of Anatolia would have been adjacent to what would have been the Russian Empire. And I think that some within the Ottoman hierarchy made the argument that that there was some question about the loyalty of the Armenians and whether indeed they identified with the Ottoman Empire or whether they identified with the Russian Empire. And there were some questions about whether, in fact, there weren't among the Armenians people who were actually working for the interest of the Russians and against the interest of the Ottomans. Is there anything to that?
This is the basic propaganda that we have today. The literature of Turkish self-justification lists dozens of Armenian uprisings with dates and place names. It is as though an organized, collaborative, subversive Armenian revolt were taking place in every city against the Ottoman state. And I think this picture is very problematic. Of course, Armenians, because of the suppression of the decades, were sympathetic maybe to the Russian, but there were no uprising in the eastern provinces. This was mostly a fear perception developed among the Ottoman rulers. The basic reason for us, for historian, is the loss of Ottoman, the war 1915 January. There was a major battle between Russian army and the Ottoman army in Sarıkamış, today's Kars. This is the Russian border. And in that war, Ottoman army lost 90,000 of their soldiers from 120,000. I mean, almost three-fourths of the army were destroyed. And so the Russian army were advancing towards the eastern Anatolia. The fear was, if the Russian occupies this region, they thought, the Ottoman authorities, they would establish an autonomous Armenian state in that region. So in order to hinder this process, they removed and annihilated the Armenian population. I think the Armenian uprising or Armenian cooperation in the region with Russian is a later propaganda that is developed by the Ottoman authorities.
And indeed, was the do you think that in some sense identifying the problem as the Ottomans, the leadership saw it, the problem of the Armenians there in eastern Anatolia, was somehow a way to deflect the attention from what was a truly disastrous defeat for the Ottomans at the hands of the Russians?
Yes, exactly. And we have the official documents from Ottoman archives. Interior minister of that time says that we have to solve this Armenian problem in a manner that is comprehensive, and we have to liquidate totally this problem because it allows the great power to interfere the domestic affairs of the empire. It has nothing to do with the Armenian activities. They thought the existence of a population gives opportunity to the big powers to interfere in the domestic affairs of a country. Then they want to solve that problem.
Were there not, in fact, Armenian soldiers in the Ottoman army?
Yes, there were soldiers in Ottoman army, and they were disarmed, and they were mostly put in the workers' labor battalions, and they were liquidated after 1915 March and April months. Hmm. And there were, of course, other Armenians, volunteers, basically coming from America, from United States, or from Europe. They were fighting on the sides of Russian army, but their military importance was not so big.
I should introduce again our guest for this hour, For anyone who might have tuned in, Tanna Akçam is a sociologist and historian. He currently teaches at the Center for Holocaust and Genocide Studies at the University of Minnesota. He is the author of a book about the Armenian Genocide. His book is A Shameful Act, The Armenian Genocide and the Question of Turkish Responsibility. Metropolitan Books is the publisher, the result of a great deal of work that he has done doing research into the documents that show that, in fact, that it was a matter of the Armenian Genocide did indeed happen, and it was a deliberate act, a result of deliberate government policy there of the Ottoman rulers. Questions, welcome, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Perhaps also you might talk a little bit about, and as I understand it, there within the Ottoman leadership, there was something of a power struggle between at least two major factions, and that perhaps also there's a connection between the policy to eliminate the Armenians and the fact that one of these two factions won.
It is true. The major party, the main party, is the Party of Union and Progress, and within this party there were two basic factions. One was the nationalist, ultra-nationalist, with certain racist tendencies, and these people got the overhand in the party after the Balkan War. The liberals, they lost their strength in the party because of this demising process of the empire. After 1911-1912, there was a change within the policy of Union and Progress Party. When they came to the power, 1908, with help of Armenian organization, with help of other reform movements, Greek, Albanians, Arab reform movements, the basic policy of the Union and Progress was unity of all subjects. They thought the only way to keep the empire together was to develop a reform program which can help every different ethnic groups within the empire. But they were not successful, and especially there was a war between Italy and Ottoman Empire. They lost the Libya today in Africa, and then before just Balkan War, they made a party congress, and in this party congress, the nationalists won the overhand in the party, and they gave up the policy of unification of all subjects within the empire, and they proceed with the dominance of Turkish nationalism in the empire. So it excludes every otherness within the empire. Mm.
We have a caller to bring into the conversation. Let's do that. Someone listening to us in Champaign, and this would be line number one. Hello.
Hi, I have two quite disparate questions. One is, do you see the guest, do you see a parallel between the fear of the Armenians organizing, as it were, and the fear that Turkey has today, and and to maybe a lesser extent the other three countries where the Kurds are, the fear of Greater Kurdistan? And the second is, do you see any parallel you studied in Germany between the policy that Turkey has denying the Armenian Holocaust and the German law that it's against the law to deny the Holocaust of World War II?
To the first question, I would say that there are strong parallels how Turkish authorities perceived the Armenian question in the past and how they perceive the Kurdish question today. It is indeed a problem that they think that the existence of Kurds in southeastern of Anatolia and in North Iraq is a threat for the existence of Turkish state. But it is, of course, a wrong policy to estimate the Kurdish existence as a threat, and they develop authoritarian solutions for that problem. If you consider the existence of a nation group as a threat, then you cannot assimilate, you cannot integrate these people within the nation state. This is the major problem that we have in Turkey today. Whether are we going to develop certain democratic structures in which the Kurds can feel themselves equal with their cultural and other identities, or really we should go ahead to see the Kurds as a threat. In that sense, we can make a parallels between past and today, and I hope that the membership in the European Union can change this traditional Turkish attitude to consider its own minorities as a threat, that Turkey starts to develop certain democratic perceptions and models to include, to integrate the Kurds in the Turkish state. The second problem regarding the denial law, there are certain attempts, not only in Germany, there are other attempts in France, for example, to make a law so that the denial will be punishable. I have certain doubts on that topic. I think that freedom of speech is essential, and the state should not sanction how should we discuss the history.
All right. Thanks for the call. It is interesting, as the caller points out, that in first of all, in Germany, it is against the law to deny the Holocaust, that is, the Nazi
yes.
program to exterminate the Jews. And in Turkey, it's against the law to acknowledge the Armenian genocide. And now, and as you say, though, in places in Europe, they have passed laws in Germany and in France, I believe, that's aimed at denial of the Armenian genocide by the Turks, and it's all, as you say, it's all tied up with the Turkish interest in joining the EU, and it's causing significant amounts of tension between, I think, people in Turkey and between people in Western Europe.
It is a very important point. Not only in Germany and France, we have to know that generally in seven different European countries, we have laws that ban the denial of genocide, but they have different characters. In some of the countries, for example, in Switzerland, it is only within the context of hate speech and anti-racism law. And Holocaust denial is considered there as a sort of anti-racist or racist attitude. So the basic problem is whether or not we can ban the genocide denial only within the context of hate speech, or we can make punishable the denied existence of the genocide. And my attitude is what is going on today in Europe is not productive, because state sanctions the historians also, and they're discussing open discussion on the history, and this must be not a correct way.
We talked a little bit earlier about the context here, the fact that the rulers, the government of the Ottoman Empire, saw its empire being dismembered, felt threatened, determined that at least within what it saw as the heartland and Anatolia, they were interested in creating a essentially what came to be called a Turkish state, but to take all people who are non-Turkish, even if they were Muslims, and to expel them, and that there was this deliberate, organized attempt to remove these people, and the Armenians were among them, Armenians who were Christians. What was the mechanism? What was the system that was set up, and what happened to the Armenians?
First of all, let me underline that it was not only Armenians who were expelled or exterminated within the Ottoman Empire during the World War I years. Mm-hmm. It was I call it demographic policy. After 1913, they made a decision that it is not possible to live with the Christian population in the empire together. And the policies which were put into the force during the period 1913-17 resulted in a complete change in the ethnic makeup of Anatolia. I mean, it's very interesting. The estimated 17 million people who lived in Anatolia at the time were so uprooted that at the end of this period, at least one-third of them had either been resettled somewhere else, deported, or annihilated. And it is very important to know that it was not only the Christian. The Muslim, non-Turkish Muslim, were also relocated and resettled in different areas in order to make them governable. And their policy towards the non-Muslim Turks was assimilation, and non-Muslim, and against the other Greeks and Assyrians and Armenians, were the extermination. The main policy towards Armenians had a two-folded mechanism. One was the official deportation order. This is what Turkey today claims, that it was a normal deportation during the war years. Deportation order was taken by government, and this order was sent to the regions, to the governors, and then the Armenians, some places they were given 2 days, in some places 24 hours, in some places maybe 15 days, and there was announcements that they had to leave their homes. And these convoys officially should be taken under the gendarmerie guard, and one governor should bring these convoys to the border of the other province, and the other should take over these convoys. This was the official deportation policy, and the aim was, according to these decrees and regulations, the Armenians should be resettled in Syria and Iraq, today's Syria and Iraq, and it was Ottoman provinces at that time. Parallel to this official deportation order, there were also, this is what we find out through the documents, that the annihilation order of the party. The decision for annihilation of Armenians was made by the Union and Progress Party. It was not a government decision. Even the government members had no idea about this decision. And this decision, the decision of destruction, annihilation, were sent to the regions by the party secretaries. The special envoys were sent to the region. And in every province, there were special units, what is called in Turkish Teşkilat-ı Mahsusa. This is a paramilitary special organization units which mostly contain people from the Kurdish tribes or people from the Caucasus or Balkan. The Muslim immigrants came with a revenge feeling against the Christian. And the third important group of these paramilitary units were the convicts. They were released from the prisons. And the number is approximately 30,000 in different provinces. These paramilitary units had certain places, and when the convoys came to that places, they attacked and they killed and annihilated the Armenian population. But the, most of the people could achieve the end seal, the Syrian and Iraq deserts. So it was more than what the Ottoman authorities expected. There was a second wave of killing in the deserts, 1916 summer months. And so most of the death came through the starvation and the weather, because they were left in the desert without any supply. So this is the was how it was organized. A twofold mechanism, one side official deportation, the other side organized by party and paramilitary organization.
Yeah, I think it's important, as you did say, to important to underscore the fact that indeed the victims of the policy were, this was not just Armenians, certainly Greeks living in Western Anatolia faced the same experience, and as you said, other people who were that now did am I right though that this people who were Turkish but who were not Muslim, the attempt there was to assimilate them.
Yes,
they didn't face the same sort of policy of expulsion that certainly the Armenians who were Christian and Greeks who were Christian on the opposite ends of Anatolia faced?
To the Greeks, it started 1914 summer months, and I have to add that it was not a general policy of extermination at the beginning, mm-hmm. because the aim was to empty the Greek villages and to send them to Greece. And most of maybe around 1 million people were sent to Greece before World War I started. And real massacres against Greek population happened during 1919-1920s in the Republic period. Against the Muslims, but non-Turkic origin was the assimilation, and they were mostly Bosnians, Albanians, and even some Kurds were relocated from eastern provinces towards the west. And it is very interesting to know, it shows that this democratic policy was planned. It was a premeditated plan. It has nothing to do with the reaction to the war, that when they emptied the Armenian villages in eastern provinces, within 1 week, they resettled Muslim immigrants from west in that villages. Mm. It shows that they were ready, prepared for this demographic policy, and the aim was for the Muslim non-Turkic origin was their assimilation within the Turkish culture.
And what is the best estimate that has been made as to the number of Armenians who died as a result of this policy?
1918, after the war, the Ottoman Interior Ministry established a commission, special commission, to investigate the Armenian losses. And according to this commission report, they made known in 1919 March, 800,000 Armenians were killed or annihilated during that period. 800,000. This number doesn't include the Armenian losses during the Caucasus period, 1919-1920s. It continued that period also. So today, we don't have the exact numbers. It varies between, some says 600,000, the other says 1.5 million. But the scholarly estimate is that around 1 million Armenian perished during that period.
Let me again introduce our guest, and we'll get to another caller here in just a moment. Taner Akçam is a sociologist and historian. He was born in Turkey, 1953. He was granted political asylum in Germany after receiving a 10-year prison sentence in Turkey for his involvement in producing a student journal, which resulted in his adoption in 1976 by Amnesty International as a prisoner of conscience, one of their first, I believe. He's the author of a number of scholarly works of history and sociology, as well as many articles in Turkish, German, and English. He currently teaches at the Center for Holocaust and Genocide Studies at University of Minnesota. He is author of a book on this subject that you can look for if you would like to read more. The title is A Shameful Act, The Armenian Genocide and the Question of Turkish Responsibility. It is published by Metropolitan Books. And I do also want to mention again that he will be visiting the campus of the University of Illinois on Thursday and will give a talk on this subject Thursday afternoon at 4. 126 Library and Information Science Building on East Daniel in Champaign. It's sponsored by the Russian East European and Eurasian Center and also the program in South Asian and Middle Eastern Studies. Questions are welcome here. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We have another caller, someone in Urbana, and this would be line number one. Hello.
Hello. How did the Imperial Archives survive these 90 years of denial, and how did you get access to them?
Today, only limited archival material survived from that period. We have to keep something in mind, that the entire state mechanism was involved in this genocidal relocation or genocidal policy. So it is impossible to destroy the entire evidences. Uh-huh. I don't know if you are aware how a state functions. If a governor, for example, sends a telegram or a report from his province to the central government in Istanbul, accordingly, this multiplied and goes to different departments, related departments. If they can delete or destroy one of them, they cannot destroy the entire documents there.
I see.
There were destructions 1919 and 1918. We know that. There were trials in Istanbul, and in this trial, the public prosecutor openly declared that three sort of documents were destroyed. One is the documents related to this special organization. Second is the entire documents of the Party Central Committee. And the third is certain files from the Interior Ministry. These are the documents which we assume that shows the direct evidence of the genocide. But the all other entire documentation survived, and today the Ottoman archive in Istanbul is one of the really good archives. Even though there are negative assessment of this archive, I would oppose that. Really, the working conditions are not bad there, and especially the last 2-3 years with the new Islamist government, there are a lot of new good attempts to open the archives to catalog new documents, and so that the scholars can go and work. It is accessible to everybody. It is a general rule. Every state keeps some documents away from the scholars. Is it even in the United States, there are certain documents which is cataloged as secret and you will never get access to that.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe in United States it is, let's say, the 95% is available to the public. In Turkey, it is maybe the 50%.
Mm-hmm.
But the existing 50% is enough to show the genocidal intent of the Ottoman authorities.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. I understand also, Professor Akçam, that perhaps one of the complicating factors here is that this material is written in, it's Turkish, but it's written in Arabic, which was what the Ottoman Empire used. And apparently, unless you're a specialist, it's very difficult to read.
This is the basic problem of Turkish people today. We don't have any access whatever happened before 1928, because 1928 there was an alphabet reform, and the Turkey changed its script from Arabic to Latin, and today's generation cannot read these newspapers, documents, books. Can you imagine a society which has no access to its own history? So this is the major problem. Only specialists, only people who can read these old Ottoman Arabic script can access, can read, and bring this into the light.
What did the governments of Europe and the United States know about this?
First of all, it is amazing that the United States government still today denies the existing of the genocide, even though the most important sources on the genocide is the American consular reports, ambassador reports, and the missionary reports. America, United States, didn't enter into the World War I until end of 1916. And they never declared war to Turkey because of the existing of the missionary activities in the Ottoman Empire. So there were dozens of American missionaries, consulars in Anatolia. They repeatedly reported to the Washington, and the newspapers of United States at that period regularly mentioned, if I'm not wrong, in New York Times, there were maybe more than 150 coverages in the front page about the massacres and killings. And so this is one of the important sources of the Armenian genocide. And they knew what happened to Armenians. But after the World War I ended, the American interest, the economic interest, was more important than the human rights issue. They dropped any follow-up policies.
And that, it seems that that is indeed the story. If one asks the question, why is it that those responsible weren't held accountable, And it's not that there weren't attempts, but perhaps it does have to do with the fact that in Europe and the United States, they were interested in moving on. They had both political and economic interests in the region, and they simply felt that it just wasn't in their interest, apparently, to make a big issue of this.
It is true, but there is another factor which was important at that period. I think everyone agreed at that time, 1919, that what happened was a crime, and this should be brought to the trial, and the punishment of the first-hand criminals as well as some of the top union and progress leaders was necessary. This was everyone agreed on that problem. But the basic question at that period, how should the punishment should be? And in that policy, I think the Britain made a big mistake because they thought the punishment of the Ottoman Empire should be in form of dismemberment of the Ottoman state into new states created on its own territory. And Turkish nationalists, the leader of the Turkish nationalists, Mustafa Kemal, which I put the title of my book as Shameful Act, he called 1915 as a shameful act, he agreed for the punishment of the perpetrator under only one condition, that the Ottoman state should keep its remaining territories. Dismemberment should not be a policy of punishment. And Britain insists on this policy so that the Turkish nationalists dropped their support of the criminal investigation against the perpetrator, so that today in Turkey, this is another important problem that you face, if you ask any common Turks about the trials in Istanbul, they will argue that it was a part of partition policy. So denial is a sort of security policy today. We think that this partition of Ottoman Empire and punishment is the same thing, punishment of perpetrator. This was the British policy, and it was a very wrong policy, and so we forget all these prosecutions against the criminal during that period.
You talked a little bit earlier about the fact that while the government of Turkey does acknowledge that hundreds of thousands of them died in this period, they deny that this was the result of deliberate government policy.
Yes.
That it was it was related to World War One. There was intercommunal fighting. They say that they have ways of explaining what happened, but indeed they say this was not deliberate government policy. We do know now that it is against the law to suggest otherwise in Turkey, that people have been charged under this law, particularly Turkey's best known writer, that is best known outside of Turkey, Orhan Pamuk. Another writer, a novelist, Elif Shafak, has gotten in trouble for this, and very sadly, not very long ago, on the 19th of January, an Armenian journalist named Front Dink was murdered in Istanbul, and he certainly was somebody who had spoken out very publicly on this. There has been some suggestion that his death maybe might have changed some people's minds, or at least might get some people talking about this. And I wonder if you could talk about him and about what happened to him, and whether indeed you think that this is somehow going to result in maybe more public discussion about this in Turkey.
Hrant Dink was a very close friend of mine. I stayed at his home whenever I went to Istanbul, and his journal, Agos, this is the weekly journal, Armenian-Turkish journal in Istanbul, I am a columnist in that journal. I knew him very well, and he was a very outspoken representative of Armenian community in Istanbul, and he was very courageful person, and his death directly related with his outspoken policy he was against the discrimination of minorities in Turkey. He was insisting on his Armenian identity, and he was openly challenging the authorities that the Turkey should face its own history. Because of that, there were a lot of criminal investigation against him. He was dragged from one courtroom to another, and recently a criminal investigation is filed against me because I supported his position and his freedom of speech, and now this criminal investigation against me from the same notorious Turkish Penal Code 301 is on the way against myself also. Mm-hmm. What we see in these days in Turkey is that really 100,000 people participated in his funeral. It gives us a certain hope that majority of people now wants to see a change in the policy of Turkish government towards its own minorities in Turkey. I have to give the readers, listeners, one example. Still, according to Turkish judicial system, the Armenians or the Christians were considered as alien citizens. They are not considered as normal citizen of Turkey, alien citizen. This is the court decision. So the equality between Christians, this is a small minority of group in Istanbul, maybe altogether 100,000-150,000, and they are not seen equals with the other with other Turkish citizens. And I hope his death can cause certain changes in Turkey.
One wonders, though, it's not difficult to imagine that, in fact, that the positive result that you suggest might happen, that that Turkish people and the Turkish government might say that our current policy should change, and that that might happen, and yet at the same time, that there would not, still would not be the official acknowledgement that, in fact, the Armenian genocide did take place and it was a result of deliberate policy. I could imagine some people saying, well, that was then and this is now, and let's deal with now and try to forget about then.
Definitely, it's true, but indeed an open discussion, a freedom of speech in Turkey is very important and very crucial. The society should have the possibility to discuss openly about the past without fear of punishment, without fear of getting killed. The threat against intellectuals, against the pro-democracy movement, is very high in Turkey. Orhan Pamuk, the Nobel Prize winner, he left Turkey forever. He couldn't live in Turkey. And this is really a shame for a country if this country cannot guarantee the life of its intellectuals.
Well, I know, in fact, that Elif Shafak was planning on doing some traveling actually here in the United States to talk about her new, she has a new novel. And apparently, yes, after Hrant Dink was killed, she severely cut back her travel plans here in this country. So obviously she was feeling that there was reason to be afraid even here in the United States.
It is true, and it is a part of the battle that's going on in Turkey. On the one side, there are forces, people who are working for a democratic Turkey that respects human rights and is ready to face its history on the one side. And on the other side is the unelected, authoritarian, military bureaucratic complex that refuses to relinquish its grip on power. And the elected government of Turkey is caught in the middle of this fight, and I hope they will proceed with their reform movement towards the membership of European Union, and it can change something. Otherwise, what we are going to face in Turkey is a different sort of fascism what we know from Germany.
Well, Ed, as you say, I think that the hope is that I suppose the hope is many people is that the Turkey's application to become member of the EU, which is something that will take a number of years, but is moving along. And as a part of this in Europe, they've insisted on a number of changes in Turkey, political changes, economic changes. And one of the things that people in Europe are concerned about, is, as you mentioned, is this Article 301. Do you in fact think, and I guess it's my understanding, too, that some people in Turkey have reacted kind of negatively to the pressure for them to change from Europe, and that maybe has resulted in some lessening of interest among the people of Turkey in joining the EU. Do you think that this still has the potential for being a force for change in Turkey, that is, the drive to join the EU?
Still, the majority of Turkish population wants to be a member of European Union. I can give an example, maybe. Hrant thinks there were more than 100,000 people participated in Hrant Dink's funeral, and there were another demonstration in Istanbul to protest the funeral of Hrant Dink, organized by ultra-nationalists, and there were only 200 participants. And we have been talking about rising tide of ultra-nationalism in Turkey for a long time. But I think what we are seeing here is the rising tide of democracy in Turkey also. And majority of Turkish people wants to be a member of European Union. And it is a very healthy process. And I hope this process should not stop or hindered by European powers or by this military bureaucratic complex in Turkey, so that Turkey become a democratic country.
Well, there we will have to stop. We are here at the end of the time. For people who want to read more on the subject, you look for the book we've mentioned, A Shameful Act, The Armenian Genocide and the Question of Turkish Responsibility, published last fall by Metropolitan Books, by our guest, Tanerek Cham. He is currently teaching at the Center for Holocaust and Genocide Studies at the University of Minnesota, and he will be here in Champaign-Urbana on the campus to talk about this same subject on Thursday, the 8th, 4 o'clock in the afternoon, 126 Library and Information Science Building on East Daniel on the campus. Professor Akçam, thank you very much.
I thank you.